Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Welcome to episode 9 of Global Solutions. School's out for summer, school's out forever. In this new world of quickly changing, often conflicting laws post-pandemic, we will boil down what employers need to know to solve problems globally and manage risk. I am Enrique del Cuerdo Perez, of counsel with the Cross-Border Practice Group at Ogletree Deacons, and joining me today is my colleague, Chris Anderson, also of counsel with the Cross-Border Practice Group. Today, Chris and I discuss school closures and reopenings around the world and their impact on working parents.
Thanks, Enrique. Let's start with the scope of closures. Kind of start at the beginning here. If you heard the intro song there, sort of Alice Cooper's song from the 80s, School's Out for Summer, School's Out Forever, is what we used. And it really gets to the idea of the beginning of COVID-19. It all happened so quickly, and no one was really prepared for the scope of it, and nor could we have been. There's one study from UNESCO that as of mid-April, 192 countries had closed all of their schools, accounting for more than 90% of the world's students, 1.6 billion people. Today, those numbers are closer to 60%. Even though it's gone down some, you get an idea of how widespread the closures were and still are.
Well, this closures have, you know, certainly affected students. They also have immediately affected the working parents of those students and their employers as well. So, now employees have to work from home, and many employees who cannot work from home have had to use their accrued vacation leave, assuming they have that benefit. And in many cases, they've had to either take an unpaid leave or, in the worst case scenario, lose their jobs unless their country has some sort of like job protected leave.
That's right. And in addition to using leave, generally, we look specifically at just when they are at work, just the effect on working hours and productivity with children in the home. Employees have had to suddenly become teachers in addition to doing their jobs. And so we see that flexibility becomes paramount, but the unfortunate fact is that not all jobs are able to flex.
Right. And also, you know, all of this has had an effect on and gender income gap, right? If you have two earner households and there's no paid leave available, then you're basically forced to choose a caretaker or, you know, pay out the out of pocket, you know, the alternative childcare cause. So it's certainly a difficult situation for everyone.
As parents of young children ourselves, Enrique, this all hits very close to home for you and I, doesn't it? I have four children, three of which are school age, elementary and middle school age, and then the other is a preschooler. So really all four are in some kind of childcare. So suddenly having to balance work and childcare duties and teaching duties with my wife, who's a pediatrician, proved very difficult, especially for her. She's a part-time pediatrician, so it fell on her more than on me as a full-time attorney, but we had to flex together. And there were many times where I had surprise guests for Zoom calls, and even one time where I was on a Zoom call and my three-year-old was running around the house and outside of the house, and I had to chase her down. And hard moments, but also some light and good moments in that as well. I've gotten to know clients better and attorneys we work with around the world. I've gotten to know them more personally because of the Zoom calls, but it definitely comes with some hard things as well.
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, clients have been very patient and gracious, too. I mean, they understand that all of us are in the same boat, and a lot of our clients are also working from home. I would say that most of the ones I've been dealing with, you know, have kids. But I got to tell you something. I've told you this before. I tell it, you know, to you again now. I truly admire you, you know, for being able to strike a balance. I mean, in my case, I have a similar situation to you, but, you know, I only have two kids, one of preschool age and an 8-month-old baby. And my wife is also a doctor. And, you know, she spends, you know, half of the time home doing telemedicine, half of the time at the hospital. And, you know, up on top of the concerns of, you know, our wife getting sick with COVID, you have to deal with work and being a parent, being kind of a teacher at home simultaneously while staying productive at work and conducting Zoom meetings. As you said, you know, sometimes you get some surprising guests, and being successful in every role can be very physically and mentally taxing.
That's right, Enrique. And all of the parenting and employment issues that we've talked about generally and specifically for ourselves, combined with a myriad of articles and reports on lower quality of online education as compared to in-person, potential negative effects of extended isolation on kids, food scarcity, even in some situations, especially in lower income areas, and studies even showing a rise in physical abuse in certain areas in certain countries around the world, have led to a global, but definitely not a universal, push for schools to reopen. Just one example of that, Enrique, is there's an open letter from the UK, Royal College of Pediatrics, 1,500 members of them put out a statement saying that the risk of continued closures is the risk of scarring the life chances of a generation of young people. So obviously a very stark, pretty serious statement from these pediatricians in the UK.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that, you know, everyone, especially, you know, parents are very concerned about what's going to happen with kids, you know, moving forward. Are they going to really be able to get the experiences, the learning experiences they need, or is this going to be basically a lost year? Hopefully not. As a reopening has begun in certain countries around the world, and it, of course, is set to begin in many others, there's a lack of scientific consensus on both the virus's transmission and to and from children and the overall impact of the disease on children. So unfortunately, this lack of consensus has led to a wide variety of approaches around the world. For the next few minutes, I think that we should now turn our attention to highlight what's happening in certain countries in the Americas, EMEA, and the Asia Pacific regions. And I'm going to start first, and I'm going to talk about, let's start with the Americas. Brazil now continues to be the Latin American hotspot, and recently became infamous recognition of becoming the second country in the world to top the 100,000 deaths from COVID-19. In terms of school closures and reopenings, decisions are being taken mostly at the state and municipal levels. For example, in Sao Paulo, schools have been closed since March 23rd. Now the governor has announced that they're, you know, hoping to resume face-to-face classes in the state, but that won't happen until October the 7th. Even if that happens, you know, the return will be gradual, and, you know, it would be limited to kids of a certain age or and grades. Rio de Janeiro, the mayor was really pushing to reopen schools and return to in-person classes in the state capital, but a court ruled against that. So private schools are remain closed in Rio de Janeiro. And then we have the Amazonas state, which became the first Brazilian state to reopen public schools. Last week, nearly 110,000 high school students returned to their classrooms, and public elementary schools in Manaus, which is the Amazonas' largest city, are scheduled to reopen on August 24. Moving to Mexico, we have a very interesting development in Mexico. Schools have been closed since March the 20th, and learning, unless there are any setbacks, is scheduled to resume remotely on August 24th. So officials in Mexico have decided to keep public elementary and secondary schools closed indefinitely. And what they'll do is they'll have the nation's 30 million students begin the new academic year at home, but instead of taking online classes, they will be watching TV. So authorities have turned to television as preferred method for learning activities in Mexico. This is because, you know, 94% of Mexican families have TV in a country where 4 in 10 homes lack internet access. You know, doing online classes was really not a viable option. So Mexico is turning to televised learning. I think it's a very interesting development. With regard to Canada, every province and territory will be slightly different. At this time, the situation in Canada, it's conducive to most of the provinces and territories reopening schools. Provinces as Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia are eyeing a return in September. One country in South America, surprisingly, has decided to cancel the school year entirely. And I'm talking about Bolivia. And this shows how sometimes, you know, countries that are poorer, unfortunately, are being affected in a more significant way than wealthier countries. So in Bolivia, officials concluded that moving classes online because of the lack of internet access was really not something that was viable. So they've decided to cancel the entire school year. And then I finished the Americas with the U.S., where, you know, we are kind of like over the place. Parents, myself included, are torn as some schools face greater reopening risks. And as I mentioned, the case of Bolivia and the U.S. also, you know, the virus has affected poorer school communities more severely than wealthier areas. And, you know, the data shows that a far greater risk to the health and safety of students, teachers, bus drivers, parents, and elderly relatives, it connected to schools in areas with, you know, high infection rates. I would say that while many of the nation's, you know, largest school systems have opted in recent weeks to start the academic year online, we've seen other, you know, places like states like Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, Indiana, where some schools, particularly in suburban areas, have been opening, and some places they've been open for almost 2 weeks. In Georgia, we have that case where in Cherokee County, that school district recently reopened, and it's been in the news because almost 900 students have gotten infected since school reopened. Also, we have Florida, where, for example, where I'm at, you know, Miami-Dade County, public schools are not scheduled to resume activities until the end of August, and it's going to be online. In my personal case, my child goes to a, you know, private preschool, and unfortunately, they're not going to offer online learning. So it's a difficult situation to face and definitely a complex decision to make.
Adding to that, we'll turn now to EMEA, Europe, Middle East, and Africa. In Europe, at least, there's a general consensus that schools should reopen across the board, for the most part. Fairly uniform in approach. They're doing some reduced class sizes is a key part of that approach. Increased sanitation, of course. And there's what's called the bubble protective model, where kids flow in a small group together throughout the day. And that's being picked up in other countries as well, including the U.S. and lots of places. But in that first started in Europe and Denmark, and then now it's expanding and other countries have used it. The Middle East and Africa are less uniform in their approach in terms of opening and closing generally, and then how it would be done specifically. But let's look at a few different countries on this. First, Sweden was the only European country not to close at all, with the minor exception of older students in grades 10 to 12, closed for 1 month, but they never closed for any younger students. Most listeners have seen some reports on this. They've got mixed reviews for, depending on who you ask, for whether that was a good thing or not, or the proper course of action. But that's the course they took, and they haven't seen any major spike in cases. And studies are on par with other European countries, including Finland, regarding exposure to and rates of infection of school children. And then turn to Denmark, who has a school year from August to June, and they're the first Western country to reopen schools. And they did that on April 15th for 2 to 12 year olds and followed up on May 18th for the rest of students. And they, as I said in the introduction remarks, they began using this micro bubble group concept that is now being used in other countries, and it's been picked up by Germany and Finland and Norway, among others, in Europe. And as with Sweden, they haven't seen any major spike in cases either, with their increased hygiene practices, social distancing where possible, masks are not required in these countries, as they are in Asia-Pac that we'll talk about in a little bit. In turning to the UK, in the Republic of Ireland, Scotland, and England, there have been some localized lockdown measures societally just in the past few weeks due to current spikes in COVID-19. But it's really unlikely to affect planned school openings, we think, right now, although we don't have a crystal ball. But it looks like the thrust, and per my comment a few minutes ago regarding the pediatricians in the UK, there's a real push to get kids back in school physically. And so it looks like between now and September, that likely won't change. But the UK is likely to make more decisions to protect that and move towards that while possibly closing down other things outside of school. And there are various start times. Scotland, it was slated to start this week, and then others are starting in early September. And as with Sweden and Denmark and other countries in the region, there's no mask mandate for schools. And they're also using the bubble protective method as well of children going in small groups through the day for the most part. Turning to the Middle East, one example is Israel. There have been a lot of case studies that have come out on Israel and their reopening. They reopened May 17th, and at that time they had very low COVID numbers generally. But the problem arose fairly quickly that they had tight schools overall, you know, in space-wise, combining with hotter summer months. And you know, they quickly, in many cases, departed from their ventilation plans of having open windows, wanted to take masks off. A lot of kids were complaining about that, and schools in many cases weren't enforcing it, at least according to the initial guidelines. And very quickly, they had more than 240 schools within a month had to reclose, and over 22,000 students and teachers ended up being quarantined. And by the end of June, just 1 month and a few weeks after opening back up, 977 teachers and students had contracted COVID-19. So clearly it's a counterbalance to this, because talk about a lot of EMEA countries where there has been no spike in infection, but in Israel there was. And so this virus, I think we all can agree, is hard to pin down the effect it has and who it's going to affect. They're set to reopen September 1st, and only grades 2 and lower will be full class size. They're going to split the groups, split the older kids into groups of 18, and then have an online model also for grades 5 and above. Finally, for Africa, just one exemplar country, South Africa, their school year runs from January to December, and they reopened June 1st. And then, kind of like with Israel, had to close again in late July amid a big second wave where that saw South Africa become fifth highest number of COVID cases in the world by the end of July. There was already a break scheduled for August, so the plan is to close for a month between the end of July, the end of August, and then start up again at that time.
Okay, so now we turn our attention to the Asia-Pacific countries. Many reopened in May and then had to close again because there had some surges in cases. Schools had reopened with strict safety measures in place, mask requirements, temperature checks, even with robots, reduced classroom size, hand sanitizer on the way into school, and having the bottoms of the shoes disinfected on the way to the classroom, and also desk dividers.
That's right. And then let's focus on one to start with, Enrique. We'll look at Taiwan, which was the only country in the Asia Pacific region that never closed their schools, except for they just gave an extended winter break. So they didn't close down due to COVID-19. They just gave an additional 2 weeks in February as things started to surge in that first run of cases. And then they're on summer break right now. The school year runs from September to June in Taiwan. So they're on summer break, but they're expected to reopen September 1st in the new semester with a lot of the strict safety measures you talked about, including contact tracing as well. And it's all ages are going to be back, no max class sizes. They will have face masks required and temperature checks on the way in as well there in Taiwan.
Yeah, another country that in Asia-Pac that is doing contact tracing in addition to all the safety measures you referenced, it's Korea. Korea usually has, you know, the normal school year from March to February. Most of the countries in Asia-Pac had reopened in May, but it had closed. Now they're back to, they have resumed learning activities in person, but they're doing contact tracing.
And we're seeing that fairly consistently across the Asian countries, China, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan. They're typically following a fairly consistent model with some variation.
Yeah. So next one, contact tracing it seems to be a very useful tool in, you know, this the battle against you know, the transmission of COVID. But it appears that it works better in those countries in which, you know, they've been able to keep the number of infections down. Otherwise, it's not helpful.
I agree, and that's one of the things we mentioned earlier for Israel, that there wasn't the level of contact tracing applied, and that was part of what arguably led to those spikes there that they saw in Israel. The next country we'll look at is India. Their school year runs from April to March. They were going to open in September, but now due to a current spike another wave in cases. They are they've changed that, and there's no set time now for when they'll open schools. But it'll be sometime between September and November, depending on the area of the country, with the idea of being to reopen for senior level students first and then lower level students after that.
Now we close this region of the world with New Zealand. And as some of you may know, New Zealand has been in the news as of late, you know, past few days, because they went for a very long period without having any new cases. I think it was almost 100 days or even a little bit more than 100 days. And they unfortunately now have 4 or 5 new cases. But, you know, because of that, because of, you know, the amazing work and the commendable work they had done keeping the infection numbers down, all schools had reopened since May. And with basically no restrictions, you know, all ages, all grades came back, no limitation on the class size, you know, as the other countries are doing physical distancing and contact tracing, and only people who are showing symptoms or who have been close to someone with symptoms or that are waiting for test results are the ones who are required to be isolated. Everyone else can basically return to school.
As we look at all of this together, when you think about these regions we've covered, the Americas, EMEA, and the Asia-Pac region, you know, one thing you see is all of the divergence in approaches. And a lot of it's, of course, responding to what's going on in society in general and trying to make real-time decisions to protect students, to protect and care for parents who are working, as we're focused on this presentation, and lots of other factors go into those decisions. But what you do see is that divergence. And so for countries that are not yet reopening schools physically, or for any country that has to go through a subsequent shutdown for a period of time, like in a lot of the countries we covered, Israel and the Asian countries we just covered, working parents, no matter where the country falls on that, working parents are going to have to continue to juggle work and childcare responsibilities when there is a closure. And employers are going to have to continue to comply with all applicable leave laws in that country, including special COVID-19 related leave that some countries are providing. When we think about that, you're having to give, you know, what's already there, like parental leave or carer's leave, whatever the country gives, but then additional leaves that are on top. We're going to be covering that in the next few weeks with a special presentation, a special podcast on leaves. So stay tuned for that. But Enrique, take it from there.
Okay, so now we're, you know, keeping this consistent with, you know, the countries that I talked about in the Americas about, you know, reopening schools and what they're doing there. Here's a few countries in Americas that have leaves available for parents to take care of their children in those places where schools either remain closed or have reopened and are learning activities are being conducted online or remotely. So we have the U.S., we have the families, the leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. As you know, as some of you may know, employers with less than 500 employees must allow employees up to 12 weeks of paid family leave if they're unable to work or telework because, you know, their children's school has been closed or the child care provider is unavailable because of coronavirus. Brazil doesn't have one. Mexico doesn't have one yet. But as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Mexico is has turned to television to continue with, you know, learning activities in the country. So Secretary of Education has mentioned that they're coming up with a plan to help working parents with how to have the flexibility to, you know, take care of their children while, you know, at the same time, you know, they protect their jobs. As to Canada, we have British Columbia, Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, you know, the province level, you know, these provinces are offering unpaid leave of absence for COVID-19 related reasons, including when the employee is providing care for a child because of the closure of a school or a daycare facility.
To give a few examples in the other regions of the world quickly, there's in Australia, there's carer's leave that's given to parents when they have to care for a family member. 10 days per year you get paid, and then there's 2 days of unpaid leave per occurrence. So that's going to give a baseline of coverage to any parent male or female in Australia that needs to be out, yet be paid for that or unpaid. But you can see that that's quickly going to go away when there's a long-term shutdown, if that ever happened again in Australia. And so what Australia has done, among other things, is they provided for the ability for employees to double their annual leave amount of time per year and then stretch out the pay to 50% of pay for that period rather than 100% for the normal period. You can stretch it to 50% for a double amount of time. So that's one thing in Australia that has been provided. And then in Belgium, employees can reduce by their election, they can reduce their hours, working hours by 50%, 80%, or even 100% in order to care for children under the age of 12, at least until September 30th. And so, you know, stay tuned for more on that. And every, you know, lots of countries have these kinds of leave programs that you would need to look into on top of their normal statutory schemes. So there's a normal statutory amount and then these extra COVID leaves, and that will continue to change and dynamically change, we believe, as these COVID-related shutdowns and reopenings happen in various countries. And so as we close this up, Enrique, one positive point to close with is, in addition to these leave opportunities that are there for parents to take advantage of, that are working, is an emerging trend we're seeing with clients, where some of our clients are even considering going to a dedicated remote work model for efficiency and or cost related reasons. And for companies that do that, it will absolutely help alleviate some of the pressure that we've talked about, this own parents, just from having to suddenly juggle again, parenting and work and even teaching responsibilities. And that's especially true for single parents or for families where there's two working parents.
That's a great point, Chris. And even if a company does not go fully to remote working, many companies are making this issue part of their diversity and inclusion initiatives to help ensure that, you know, first, working parents are provided as much flexibility as possible during these challenging times. And second, that childcare responsibilities triggered by COVID-19 school closures do not disproportionately affect any employee's ability to overall career development. And, you know, as we all know, historically, most of the burden has been placed on female employees. But, you know, nowadays, when you have both parents are working parents, it's important that everyone has the ability to protect their jobs and at the same time, it be able to, you know, successfully meet, you know, your obligations as a parent, your obligations as you know, an employee, and also in those places where there's remote learning, your obligations as kind of a teacher at home.
That's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
It is. It is definitely difficult. You learn something every day, and every day it's full of surprises, but I think we're dealing with it successfully so far. Well, with this, we wrap up today's podcast. We thank you very much for listening, both Chris and I hope that this has been an informative look at a dynamic and shifting landscape of school closures and openings globally. Be sure to tune in to podcast number 10 of the Global Solutions series next week with our colleagues Sky Howe and Amanda Kwan, who will be discussing China's new civil code and what it might signal for global employers. So thank you so much, and until the next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.